Meet Mrs. McSugal. Her memoir bears no resemblance whatsoever to real life. It is 100% fiction and fabrication, or, to put it bluntly, complete codswallop. Indeed, none of the public figures named will recognise one grain of truth in her farcical fibs and fantasies. This satirical monologue does not represent the views or actions of any person, living or dead.
Mrs. McSugal, Scotland's second finest actress.
You couldn't make it up, but she just did. Episode 2, Starman.
It was after my moving portrayal of Babette Plachette, the demonic lollipop lady in Crime Watch on Ice, that my fame began to take its toll on poor Mummy and Daddy. They couldn't even walk round the Strathbogie Co-op without petty, spiteful comments. "We saw your genie on telly. Shame about the terrible reviews. I've read they're stopping that show of hers." "Isn't she married yet? Doesn't she want to have a family? I have 6 beautiful grandchildren myself." "That la-di-da lifestyle is all well and good, but Shakespeare won't keep you warm at night." You wouldn't believe what they had to put up with. But Mummy was an absolute gem. She would smile serenely and say, "We are very proud of our genie. Please send our regards to your grandchildren." And then she'd tell them to feck right off, and she and Daddy would go and buy their Stella Artois in peace. Things went from bad to worse when I started to be offered bit parts on number 2 tours. I'd sit for hours reading the so-called script, yellow highlighter in hand, trying to find my character. But I really didn't fancy hanging around backstage for 2 hours just to say, "Is that still or sparkling, madam?" Lovely Bill Kenwright was desperate to hire me. But I said, "Bill, you only pay enough for premierings, and I'm just not that kind of girl." I had supper with him later, and we had a good old chinwag. As we were leaving, I sent my love to Jenny Agutter, and he looked at me and said, "I don't know Jenny Agutter." I laughed and said, "You silly man, you've lived with her for decades." "No, I live with Jenny Seagrove," he said. "Oh, same difference," I said. How we laughed. The fact is, I was destined to be one of the greats. But I got tired of waiting around for someone else to notice it. Sure, I could have understudied, but I wasn't willing to play second fiddle to Eileen Atkins. She's a competent actress. I'm a competent actress. Why would one sniff the bouquets out front while the other flicks through Take a Break in the dressing room? I blame those hideous casting directors. They kept offering my roles to Helen Mirren, of all people. Every time I turned up at a casting, there she was. Looking gorgeous, I must say, but so smug in that effortlessly chic biker's jacket. I mean, anyone can imitate the Queen. Kenny Everett did it. Heavens to Betsy, Janet Brown did it every Saturday night on telly for years. I can't bear to think of the number of times I lost out on the perfect role to someone who, when it came to it, couldn't quite pull it off. It got to the point I could not bring myself to watch Meryl Streep. I am a huge admirer of her chameleon-like ability to change her hairstyle, but oh, I wish she'd worked harder on those accents. To the outside world, I was a hugely successful actress, desired by men and admired by women everywhere. And in public, at least, I never fell short of perfection. But in private, it was a different story, and I began to feel like Jane McDonald after someone had let the air out. Finally, the day came when I was admiring myself in the hall mirror, and it hit me. Jeannie Mankini, they're simply aren't enough parts for an actress as beautiful as you. And there was no way I was making myself look unattractive just for an acting role. It didn't help that at the time I was schlepping up and down to the Space Hopper Theatre, Sunderland, to play a glamorous library assistant in a terrible, terrible Dostoevsky. I spent half the time on stage stamping books and the other half getting jiggy with Leslie Phillips in a Ford Cortina. No actor should have to face that. Not with Leslie Phillips. I managed to stagger through the rest of the run and then took myself off to Southwold for a mini break with my dear friend Barbara Streisand. Barbara and I talked and talked. and it turned out we were at very similar stages in our careers. She had recently recorded a song with Donna Summer and was about to open at Caesar's Palace, and I was the new face of Flesh Creep Antifungal Cream. That weekend, we both made brave decisions. Barbara would clone her alpaca and record a yodeling concept album, and I would walk away from acting while at the peak of my career. It was time for me to give something back. I would open the most sumptuous theatrical digs in the business. That evening, as we were drooling over Joe McFadden in Take the High Road, it came to me. My theatrical digs would be in my hometown and the theatre capital of Scotland, Strathbogie. I would open my heart and my home to the poor, the needy and the degenerate, my fellow actors. I say my home, but the truth is Mummy and Daddy were very generous. I simply called them up and explained the situation, and they immediately offered to move out of the family home they'd loved for 40 years into a vintage two-berth caravan I picked up at the dump and parked in the driveway. It was bitter out there in the winter, but they always looked forward to a nice warming cuppa each morning in their kitchen. May they rest in peace, and bricks and mortar. Of course, I would have offered them a room in the house if there was the space, but how would I manage without the extra bunk beds if the Spice Girls came to stay? You couldn't put any of them in the same room. Zigga zigga, indeed. It's hardly Bob Dylan, is it? I think you'd like the peace and quiet of Strathbogie. It's what they call a handsome town with lots of craggy period features. Think Jude Law when he hit 40. But once I'd unpacked my panto causes and sat down to admire the view, I began to wonder if this whole escape to the country thing wasn't a tad overrated. That first winter was never ending. Until one reich February afternoon, I was sitting in the toot toot tea room at Strathbogie railway station when who should walk in but my future errant husband, Maurice McShugal. I can still see him standing there, legs akimbo, asking if he could squeeze his rugby player thighs onto the stool beside me. "They're the biggest in central Scotland," he said, as I sipped on my Bovril. "Are they really?" I replied, thinking, I don't remember that line in Brief Encounter. "I'm in the business," I said, once we got the formalities out of the way. But he seemed to find this hilarious and said he wasn't paying for it, if that was what I meant. I was raging, I can tell you. But before I could enlighten the Neanderthal, he mentioned he was a fireman. For some reason, that really impressed me. I'm not sure why. It may have had something to do with my guttering, but from then on, I began to see him in a whole new light. You see, poor Maurice was brought up in a strict, puritanical household on the Isle of Bohuki, so he wasn't much of a talker or a toucher, if you know what I'm saying. I'm a great admirer of Mother Nature, but what was she thinking when she decided to allow a straight man and a straight woman to procreate? We girlies need a woman's mind in a man's body, someone like Tom Hardy, for example. But try as I might, I could not find Maurice's hidden depths. In the end, I resorted to playing Islands in the Stream over and over, but even that didn't turn him into a free thinker. I blamed his mother, old Mrs. McDanvers. She didn't approve of her son dating an actress. I can still see that pinched face swathed in shawls and screaming at me for hanging my Victoria's Secrets out to dry on a Sunday. "The devil will have you," she shouted. "He already has, love," I shouted back. Maurice and I got married after a couple of weeks, which we felt was ample time to get to know each other and to plan a wedding for about 100 guests. But with hindsight, it may have been a teensy bit premature. I blame all the improvisation at drama school. It has left me hopelessly spontaneous. And before you could say the gift list is at Jenner's, I was walking down the aisle as Mrs. Maurice McShugal. It really was the most glorious day. The ceremony was held on a deserted beach in Scotland's Hawaii, Millport. It was so romantic, despite the hailstones and gale force winds, and the RNLI were super helpful when our photographer managed to get herself swept out to sea. Morris was all for wading in to save her, but I said not to bother, as Auntie Suki and Uncle Juan had found a buy one, get one free deal on disposable cameras, so we'd manage. Later, we retired to the celebrity little chef at the Adrossan Motorway Services for a slap-up meal and the all-important speeches. Darling Daddy brought the house down when he thanked Morris for giving me a go and reassured him there would be no hard feelings if he met someone better. But I'm sorry to say Morris spectacularly failed to embrace the spirit of the occasion. The filthy fireman human was neither here nor there, but he lost us completely with his ruminations on Jean-Paul Sartre's existentialism and the alpha male. By the time he thanked his ex-girlfriend, Raivita, for helping to make him a man, he was getting on my wick, so I interrupted him to ask if it was Raivita who gave him the little social disease which made his groin that peculiar colour. I gave her a little wave to show there were no hard feelings, and he rather lost his thread and sat down shortly afterwards, much to everyone's relief. Thankfully, the people's friend picked up the tab for the whole shebang, as I had arranged a lucrative deal for exclusive access and photos on the condition we got some famous faces along. They were insistent we up the celebrity quota by inviting Keith Chegwin and Hilary DeVay, even though we'd never met them in our lives. Cheggers was in the middle of his wilderness years, bless him, so he jumped at the chance of a hot meal. But Hilary was much harder to pin down, with all sorts of demands being faxed across by her people. In the end, I won her over by saying Dame Dawn French was coming. On the day, she kept pestering me, saying, "Where's the dame? Where is she?" So in the end, I took her hand and I led her over to Tony, my outrageous drag queen friend. "Dame Dawn, Hilary. Hilary, Dame Dawn," I said, and left them to it. Well, she never twigged the whole evening. Every time I passed them, I could hear her prattling on about the Vicar of Dibley changing her life. Tony told me later he'd never heard of Hilary DeVay, and he thought he'd been talking to another rather over-the-top drag queen all night. But as Morris and I waved cheery bye to our family and friends, we faced the same problem as so many newlyweds. With the wedding over, we had bugger all left to talk about. I had seen the signs on our third date, when we had a series of explosive rows trying to choose our first dance of the evening. He wanted "You're So Vain." He said it reminded him of me, which was sweet, but I got my way naturel, and I chose Susan Boyle's delightful cover of "Love Will Tear Us Apart." And don't believe the hype about the so-called honeymoon period. Even on our wedding night, after we returned to the Hotel Brigadoon, Morris started asking for some very strange things in bed. I told him I was not dressing up as Carmen Miranda, nor was I prepared to do river dance at double speed just to spice up our failing honeymoon. It wasn't a great start, and so much for sacred vows. 5 weeks later. 5 weeks, I tell you. He's only flaunting his thighs to Britney Spears' sister, Broccoli. She seemed like such a sweet young thing when she arrived to stay, and I rather took her under my wing, even pretending to like Britney's music. That took all my play-it-for-real tips from Dickie Attenborough, I can tell you. But I knew something was up when she started asking for extra oranges and bananas in her fruit bowl. She could not get enough of them, until finally it hit me. He'd found his Carmen Miranda. I had it out with a pair of them that evening, after Lawrence Fox had finally got bored of us out of his own voice, and she was at least contrite. "Oops, I did it again," she said, and burst into tears. As for Morris, he didn't say anything. He just grabbed his toolbox and moved in with his mate Pongo. I was in pieces. I'd given him my heart and all those Viennettas, and this was how he repaid me. I didn't leave the house for days. I just sat there staring at the telly. I sat through an entire episode of The Jewel in the Crown one evening. That's how bad it got. Morris and I only met as a married couple once or twice after that. Court appearances and on the Jeremy Kyle show, that kind of thing. Then I heard he had met someone else. Another actress, can you believe it? Name of Cindy Lou Redgrave. You won't have heard of her, she's not in spotlight, I looked. Turns out Cindy Lou Redgrave isn't even her real name. It's Kelly Bung. But she wanted everyone to think she was one of the Redgraves. Vanessa was furious when I told her. I have enough bloody Redgraves to compete with without another one, she said. Morris and I had talked about having children and building an acting dynasty. But the truth is we couldn't be fagged. All that extra workload, and I had my darling cats, Kate O'Mara and Sydney Poitier, to think of. They would have hated the inconvenience and the noise. I've always had a strict no-children rule in the house, apart from once when, as a special favour to Raisa Gorbachev, I allowed the cast of The Famous Five to stay. They were polite enough kids to have around, but Gordon Bennett, they took the Stanislavski method so seriously. I had to put my foot down when they went round to the neat little council estate behind me and flashed their torches through the window shouting, "You're working class and up to no good." I told them it really isn't healthy to live and breathe a dramatic role 24/7. Look at poor Daniel Day-Lewis, not to mention Martine McCutcheon. But did they listen? Did they, Humperdinck? After a couple of days, I ended up putting sleeping pills in their ready brick just to try and keep the noise down. One night, Dick and George asked me, "Mrs. McShugle, Mrs. McShugle, can we have a lager with our meal instead of ginger pop?" "Well, I don't remember the Famous Five drinking lager," I said, but they assured me they did. "Oh, you must be thinking of the Secret Seven," said Dick. "They were teetotal." "How old are you?" I asked. 15, they said. "Oh, what the hell," I said, "a couple of cans won't do any harm." And they seemed to know their Fosters from the Budweiser. Well, you can guess the rest. Years later, I looked them up on IMDb, which happens to give their dates of birth. Turns out they were only 9 at the time. 9! You've got to laugh.
Mrs. McShugle, Scotland's second finest actress, starred Carolyn Pickles. It was written by Jonathan Fortingall. Sound by Norman Goodman. Song title is Funky Disco by Biz Baz Studio. It was directed by Colin Wakefield and produced by Yellow Brick Grove in association with Double Honours Productions. Book available on Amazon. Mrs. McShugle is dedicated to Hannah Gordon, a truly fine Scottish actress.